Welcome to the Geopolitical Ecology Podcast, where you will find critical conversations at the intersections of nature, culture, and power.
In this episode, we sit with Liam Fox to discuss the extractivist paradigm of pipelines ripping through indigenous land in so-called Canada. Liam is a PhD researcher in geography at the University of Toronto and a volunteer tenant organizer in Vancouver. He's interested in labor, community, and movement organizing strategy, and the politics of reproduction under capitalism. He sees himself as part of the undercommons of the university, those groups who carve out a living at the university but are never fully accepted or recognized by it, and never align with its dominant class interests. He holds deep desires for communism, classless societies, and the abolishment of rent. I am joined by my co-host, friend, and comrade Erica, and here is our conversation with Liam Fox. Liam, thank you so much for joining us today. You and I have known each other for quite a bit. We actually used to live together for a while back in Toronto. And I even recall the first time I started exploring what the field of geography had to offer in terms of critical thinking, in terms of even certain topics that are being looked at that maybe other disciplines aren't looking at, was through you and living with you and having that exposure. So I'm really excited about this conversation with you, excited to have Erica also get to know you through this. And we have some questions prepared for you based on the paper that you published with Antipode in 2022, titled Pipelines in the Public Interest. Has a slightly longer title, but I won't say the whole thing. We are obviously going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about your PhD research, which you are currently doing right now, in the process of completing your dissertation, your PhD at U of T. How about we begin by asking you how you got to where you are today and what made you interested in studying extractivism in the energy and the energy transition, or in the energy transition. And that's just one way to put it. I know you look at many other things that relate to this and somehow maybe don't. So to you, Liam.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having me. Also, I'm really happy to be here and chat with you guys today. I guess maybe I'll start by way of talking about my experience, my short experience as a resource worker, I think got me interested in a lot of the questions that I currently look at in my research. So when I was doing my undergrad at the University of Toronto, in the summers, I went out and I tree planted for a bunch of years as a way of kind of just covering my cost of living and tuition and everything. And it was originally, I think this part's important, it was advertised to me by my friends who had done it before as a way that you could actually cover all of your costs for the year and you would only have to work in the summer. So you could go out, make a bunch of money, and then you could cover your costs for the rest of the year. And this is kind of like a big theme for a lot of resource work. This is the way that, this is the attraction for a lot of people, is depending on wherever you are in the economy in Canada or wherever, you can go out to these extractive sites and you can make a bunch of money, and then you can go off and do whatever after that. And so this was really attractive to me. And so I went out for my first year, I went to Northern Ontario, around the Kirkland Lake and Timmins area, and I tree planted up there. I would not recommend it. The black flies in particular, they were pretty horrendous. And then in the subsequent summers, I went out to British Columbia and I planted in the interior region. So around towns like Kamloops and Barrier, Williams Lake. And these are like primarily resource towns. And so I was spending quite a bit of time in these towns. They're unlike any places that I'd ever been to. I grew up in Southern Ontario in a town called Collingwood, which actually interestingly also has a connection to resource extraction, but you wouldn't know it today if you went to Collingwood. It's very much kind of like a tourist economy. Sorry if you can hear my cat meowing in the background also. Yeah, it's a sunny day out, so she wants to go hunt mice. So I went out and I spent a lot of time in these resource towns. And I think one thing that really struck me, tree planting, was first of all, like the lived experience of like resource dependence and, you know, resource hegemony. You can really feel it when you go to a lot of these resource towns. You know, how Harold Innes famously talked about the resource boom and bust cycle as being kind of similar to like a hurricane. So it comes into these towns and it touches down and, you know, it creates a ton of investment and a ton of profit for a lot of people in a very short amount of time. And then it leaves and it kind of leaves everything devastated. And it leaves the people devastated, it leaves communities devastated. You know, you go to these places and I don't want to pathologize them at all because, you know, I don't have a strong relationship to these communities. So I'm not, you know, saying that this is, I'm not trying to talk shit about your towns. But you go there and you see, I think, very visible poverty. You see very visible addiction. You see a lot of violence, both in the landscape and in the communities. And I think there's a lot of beauty in these places too. But it's really hard to go to these places and not to see that violence, especially on the landscapes. I mean, I'll never forget the first time that I stepped foot on like a clear cut block when I first started tree planting. Like it really does affect you. Like you can't go back from that. Like it's very visceral. And so I think those experiences over those years, like they really changed me. They really changed my perspectives on, you know, well, first of all, resource work in general. Not that I would identify myself as a resource worker compared to, say, an oil and gas person in Alberta, but I do think that I have like a bit of a closer relationship to the resource economy. And because of that, I've kind of seen things, I think, from that perspective, of what it's like to kind of depend on the resource economy for your livelihood and what you kind of have to go through, the trauma that you have to go through when you are a resource worker, whether you recognize it or not. It really affects your community. It affects you, it affects your worldview. And so all of these things, you know, when I was starting out my master's research at Simon Fraser in Vancouver, in Burnaby, I couldn't not do a project about something about resource economies and something specifically kind of like from worker perspectives.
Mm-hmm. And what was it on?
So it was on the Trans Mountain Pipeline. When I first got to Vancouver, I got involved with some various kind of like community organizing actions, trying to block the construction of the Trans Mountain Pipeline. This was the Protect the Inlet movement in Vancouver. It was like an Indigenous-led climate justice movement, kind of around 2015 or so to 2019.
Right.
And there's so much work that was happening at that time, trying to actually block construction, trying to prevent the approval of this pipeline in particular. So just as like a little bit of context, the Trans Mountain Pipeline is a bituminous pipeline. It carries diluted bitumen, which is like a kind of oil from Alberta. It runs from Hard City, Alberta, which is just south of Edmonton, and it goes all the way to Burnaby, which is near Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And it carries bitumen that was mined in the oil sands for the most part in Alberta. And so this pipeline was built in the 50s. It carried around 500,000 barrels per day of oil from Alberta to Vancouver. And most of that oil is getting shipped to California to go to refineries there, which is then quite a bit of that is then exported and then some of it's imported back into Canada. And so this project had been in the works for a long time, but essentially in the kind of mid-2000s, there was a proposal from Trans Mountain, which is the company that ran the pipeline, to expand the pipeline. So to build a second pipeline alongside this one. So you'd have two pipelines, and it was expected to more than double the carrying capacity of those pipelines. And I think they originally projected it would be somewhere around like 800,000 barrels per day of oil that they'd be able to carry. I think those numbers aren't right, so maybe don't include that. Anyway, the point is it was supposed to like massively expand the capacity of this pipeline. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of resistance to that, both kind of on the climate justice front, especially around the kind of Indigenous land defense front. So when I got here in Vancouver in 2017, this was the big showdown. This is what was happening. there were these massive climate justice rallies that were kind of all about the Trans Mountain Pipeline. And there were a lot of actions where people were actually going and getting arrested, like masses of people who were getting arrested, blocking worker access to the pipeline terminals and this kind of thing. And so I got arrested a couple times as part of those initiatives. And so this kind of really ignited my interest in all these pipeline questions. And specific to my project, I went to this one rally at Science World in Vancouver, and I think 2018. And at the time, one of the speakers, this is Ruben George, who's one of the chiefs of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation. This is one of the nations in Vancouver whose land Vancouver, what's now called Vancouver, actually sits on, along with the Squamish and the Musqueam nations. And so Ruben George, I remember he was talking about the fact that Justin Trudeau's government was talking about approving this pipeline in the national interest. And Ruben George was basically saying, which nation, like whose nation are you talking about here? Definitely not the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, you know? And that got me really interested in this concept of the national interest, because I think before that, it just seemed something like very almost unquestionable to me. You hear like this pipeline is going to be in the national interest. And for a lot of people, you don't even question what that means. And it wasn't really until I had heard Ruben George say that, that I was like, you know, this is a question that I think needs a lot more investigation. And specifically the role of this institution called the National Energy Board, which is responsible for making that determination of whether or not a pipeline is going to be in the so-called national interest. So that's how this all started.
Yeah. And so this is quite pertinent, and we see it a lot in your paper that I mentioned earlier, your 2022 Antipode paper. So we see a shift from the use of public interest, which really lasted for decades, alongside this institution, the National Energy Board, that you investigate in a pretty in-depth fashion. And then towards the end, you do discuss how that shift from public interest to national interest has certain connotations that do kind of represent a shift, I guess, even in terms of coloniality and how coloniality is expressed. Like there has been this long tradition of what you call, or not necessarily you call it, but you refer to it, of liberal thought that utilizes utilitarianism and this concept of public interest that is somehow, from what I understand in your paper, this kind of like amalgamation of, yes, there are competing interests, but overall there is a socially optimal kind of point where a public in the abstract benefits. And in its interest, this pipeline is to be built, or for instance, acres of land are to be designated for tree planting, which you discussed earlier. Could you talk to us a bit about that public interest concept and the shift towards national interest a bit more, touching on, you know, the liberal thought tradition, and maybe even how the first experience you discussed with tree planting and then the shift of focusing on pipelines, how these relate? I mean, there are very different activities, right? Land use when it comes to deforestation and reforestation, afforestation, and then, you know, oil and gas and building pipelines, etc. So I guess what I'm saying is, if you could tell us a bit also of how you understand the concept of extractivism and how it relates to the former part of this question on public interest and national interest. Sorry, it's a bit of a mouthful, but I'm sure you have a lot to say.
Great question. Yeah. Okay, so talk a little bit about the shift from public to national interest, and then about extractivism.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, just to start, I think like public interest and national interest, they're different concepts. They're not the same. They're referring to different things. They have different kind of genealogies, or at least that's kind of what I suggest in the paper. I originally started by looking at the question of the national interest, actually, because this is something that Justin Trudeau in particular had been parroting all the time. You know, like he would just talk about specifically how, you know, yeah, it's true, this pipeline, it's going to have some environmental consequences, but, you know, overall, this is going to be in the national interest. This is something that's going to benefit Canadians as a whole. This is what he kept on saying. And the reason that he was saying this originally, was that the National Energy Board, which, oh, maybe I should start with a very kind of brief overview of the National Energy Board. So the National Energy Board began, or it was instituted, it was created as an institution in basically the same time that the Trans Mountain Pipeline was created, so in the 1950s. And its purpose was originally to be kind of like a regulatory agency of pipelines, almost in the same way that you have regulatory institutions that do that regulate railways. And in fact, what's really interesting, I think now, is because I study railways a little bit more now, is the bones for the National Energy Board evolved out of railway regulation or railway regulatory agencies in Canada. So they were thinking about pipelines in kind of the same framework that they think about railways. And the thing that's really interesting about railways in a place like Canada, or really anywhere in the world, is that they tend to cross boundaries. So they present a whole bunch of regulatory issues because they're not kind of just fixed in one jurisdiction. They cross multiple jurisdictions. And so they throw up all these problems of who's going to regulate, who's in charge of constructing, who's in charge of financing. Are we going to have one kind of regulatory regime for the entire railway, or are things like tolls and fees going to change depending on what jurisdiction you're in? Like, these are all kind of questions that get thrown up because railways and pipelines are carrying stuff across borders, people and goods and capital across borders. And so the National Energy Board was created because there was a problem when Canada first started building pipelines. There was this issue of like, who's going to regulate essentially? And also who's going to pay to construct the pipeline? Because most of these pipelines at first, they were running like east to west. So they were bringing oil and gas to markets in places like Chicago, for instance, or the idea was trying to get them to markets in Montreal or to refineries in Montreal. And so there were all of these kind of like political issues around how to construct these, how to build them, and how to ensure that they're regulated efficiently. The other thing about pipelines and big infrastructures like pipelines, so railways are another good example, or another interesting one is power lines that also carry something, that carry electricity across borders, is that they cost a ton of money to build. And they're mostly, for the most part, this is money that at the time anyway, private corporations weren't really willing to shill out that money. And so they were getting the state to do it for them. This is kind of like a common theme in extractivism in general, is you want to get the state to pave the way to make the infrastructure work so that you can get the extraction flowing. And so this is kind of the context in which the National Energy Board was created. As pipelines were being constructed, as the oil sands in Alberta were being developed, more and more bitumen was like being landlocked because you can only carry so much bitumen or like oil and gas on rail. And pipelines are a much more efficient way of transporting these kinds of commodities than rail. And so there was this kind of like big crisis in Alberta in like the 40s and the 50s of like, how do we get all of this oil and gas out of this landlocked province? We need to get it to markets. And so we need these infrastructures, and we need the state to pay for the infrastructures and to regulate these infrastructures. So the National Energy Board was born with this mandate to regulate pipelines in the public interest. This is kind of like you see the public interest come up so many times in the National Energy Board's original legislation. And public interest actually has like a really long and like kind of dry and boring actually history in like regulatory theory, which is like kind of a whole genre of political theory on its own. It's like a kind of watered down or like depoliticized version of like liberal, it's like liberal governance essentially. Like, what's the formula so that we can get this governance right and kind of like avoid anything getting overly political or like overly conflict? Like, how do we kind of bracket the conflict and just kind of make it about, you know, just straight shooting regulation?
Mm-hmm. Very technocratic.
Very technocratic, exactly. And so I talk a little bit about this in the paper. I was essentially really interested at first in the relationship between a concept like the public interest or the national interest and sovereignty, because my original kind of hypothesis was that when you use a concept like public interest or national interest, when you say, you know, this pipeline is in the public interest, it's essentially a sovereign decision. So it is like the state basically saying, you know what? Screw all of this conflict. At the end of the day, we have the right to decide, and we're going to make an executive decision on this. This is in the best interest of everyone here. We're going to go through with this pipeline or whatever. I basically still think that. but when the Trudeau government in particular started talking about this pipeline being in the national interest, I think it brought in a new kind of valence of that sovereign decision, because the public interest, like we were just saying, like it is a very kind of like technocratic way of making sovereignty work or of making a sovereign decision, because you're kind of, you know, you're doing this like rational calculus. Like, so public interest, you look back at somebody like Jeremy Bentham, the famous like liberal philosopher who did talk specifically about the public interest. And one thing that he said, like a very well-known formulation of how to determine the public interest, he said, the interest of the community is the sum of the interests of the several members who compose it. So he's basically saying, all you have to do is you have to like take a spreadsheet and you have to list all of the people who live in a place, and you have to go, is this in your interest? Yes. Okay, good. Is this in your interest? No. And then you just aggregate all of those yeses and nos, and then just see which one balances the other one out. And that is the public interest.
Yeah. And in a way, it's like the national interest doesn't even have to go through that process if it's for the nation.
Exactly.
For the benefit exactly. of the nation. It doesn't matter if you have local nuance or local opposition along the way, say of a pipeline or major infrastructure problem, yeah. right? And this is kind of something yeah. you touch on the paper, which is incredible because it makes you think also of like state hegemony, what is justified and what is not justified, and the complete bypassing of the state's so-called duty to consult indigenous communities, who always are the ones who bear the brunt way more than settlers in cities, for instance,
yeah.
Of these major infrastructure projects, yeah. right?
Yeah, so I think you all are kind of touching on this a lot already, but maybe we can just be really explicit and like explaining a little bit, like, what is this framework missing? Like, what are the implications specifically on Indigenous sovereignty and like the relationship between the National Energy Board and like the nations that it's interacting with on their land? And if you have any thoughts on like how that process can be improved as well, or like incorporate more Indigenous perspectives, I think that would be really useful to kind of talk about. But thank you so much for kind of explaining all of that.
Yeah. So the first part, when I originally started researching this project, my thought was like, you know, I could probably go back and look and see when the state had done things like construct main lines through First Nation reserves or something like that. I could probably see them using this language of the public interest to justify it or something like that. It turns out the state didn't even need to justify doing that a lot of the time. The state did not justify expropriation. It was just kind of like a matter of fact kind of thing that the state could do. Because, you know, through the powers of things like the Indian Act, the state just kind of believed that it had de facto jurisdiction over Indigenous people. Indigenous people were like subjects of empire, as Glenn Coulthard puts it. And so they didn't need to go and consult them before they built a railway mainline through a reserve or anything like that. You don't really see the state starting to use this language until kind of like later in the 80s at the very earliest, I think, would be kind of, or like the late 70s, when there was the construction of the Mackenzie Valley pipeline, which was going to be going north from Alberta up through Northwest Territories. And it was going to be crossing through, well, I mean, a bunch of Indigenous territory, but specifically Dene territory in the north. And so Carly Dokas has a really interesting book on this. It's called Where the Rivers Meet, and it's about environmental assessment and kind of like the origins of environmental assessment in Canada, and how some of the first environmental assessments entailed having like quasi-judicial bodies or like judges or whoever who would go up to these communities, and they would like talk to Indigenous people there, and they'd be like, you know, tell me more about your livelihood. How is a pipeline going to affect your livelihood? This kind of stuff. That was kind of like the first big instance in Canada where they did consultation in a meaningful way. And notably, this was also in the era of a lot of like Indigenous organizing also. A lot of like, you know, the Constitution Express, which is this like very important movement of Indigenous people going to Ottawa to demand, well, actually to criticize the Trudeau senior government's white paper initiative, which was to try to assimilate all Indigenous people and get rid of all Indigenous rights and just kind of call Indigenous people all Canadian. And so Indigenous people pushed back by organizing, going to Parliament, pushing back, demanding proper recognition, and fights over things like the charter. This is all stuff, by the way, that like Glenn Coulthard has covered in his book Redskins, White Masks, I think very well.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't need to get too much into that, but that's the context of this Mackenzie Valley pipeline and when these environmental assessments started happening. So environmental assessment in Canada, especially resource related environmental assessments in the so-called hinterlands of Canada, that history is like inseparable from like Indigenous resistance essentially in Canada. So that's when the state started using concepts like public interest, and when the National Energy Board started being in charge of doing environmental assessments on behalf of the state, or would do it with in conjunction with another, like the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency or something like that. As for how it can be improved, or like if it can be improved, again, like I talk about this a little bit more in my paper, but the National Energy Board does not exist anymore. Trudeau Jr., Justin Trudeau, was elected on a promise to actually get rid of the National Energy Board and to modernize it, he called it.
Oh,
and this yeah, was directly right. in response to all the stuff that was going on with Trans Mountain at the time, because a lot of people were talking about the National Energy Board, which, by the way, it approved the first proposed Trans Mountain pipeline expansion. It approved it, and it said, you know, there's going to be minimal environmental consequences. It's no problem. This is for the national interest. This is good. And that report that the NEB conducted was so flawed, and it was taken to court so many times, that they were actually ordered to redo it, because it was just like there was very little scientific basis for any of the claims that they were making about the impacts or the benefits, essentially. They were fudging it. And so they were ordered by the Supreme Court of Canada to go back and redo the environmental assessment a second time, which they did. And then they came out the second time, this is around like, I think 2019, they came out a second time and they said, okay, there will be environmental impacts. One of which is that Southern resident killer whales, the orcas that live in the Georgia Strait, are probably going to go extinct as a result of the increased marine traffic that's going to result from this pipeline expansion, but it's still in the public interest. This is still something that overall will provide so much economic benefit for Canada that it should go forward anyway. So
is it safe to say that this is kind of the formula for assessments, where you have environmental and social consequences, which are almost always negative, and then you have economic impacts, which are almost always perceived as positive, and there's some kind of weighing that happens, and you know, mm-hmm. if the economic benefits outweigh the socio-environmental impacts, then the project is good to go.
Mm-hmm. I would argue that that's often what happens. I don't study this stuff anymore. I do know some people who do study this who actually do believe that environmental assessments can actually still be really important tools for resisting massive impacts of a lot of projects. However, especially with things like the pipeline, things that are actually seemingly so important for the Canadian national brand, really, of extractivism, then the state makes sure that they go through, they would make sure that the project happened anyway. And so, yeah, you see these environmental assessments where, yeah, it seems like the balance is always tipping in the favor of the economy over the environment, for sure.
So it's kind of framed more like in an economistic terms of there's like the market benefits and costs, and then the quote unquote externalities of like social environmental impacts. And then even within that, the public interest concept obscuring a lot of like Indigenous interests or other like marginalized folks who aren't reflected in that. Does that sound like a apt summary?
Absolutely. And so I'll just add too that when Justin Trudeau got, or he modernized the National Energy Board, because like I said, he was responding to this, all of this controversy around the National Energy Board when he was running his populist campaign to get elected in 2015. And so he made this promise, and they changed quite a bit. In 2019, The NEB was overhauled and it's now called, there's two agencies. There's the Impact Assessment Agency and there's the Canadian Energy Regulatory Agency. And so the IAA, the Impact Assessment Agency, is now the one that does the environmental impact assessments. And the CERA just is responsible for regulating things like, you know, tolls and levies and that kind of stuff. Which is kind of interesting in and of itself. It was like kind of trying to make sure that all of the potentially controversial and political stuff is only happening with the Environmental Assessment Agency. And then on the other hand, they changed the legislation to basically just include a lot more about Indigenous consultation. Because one of the big reasons that the original National Energy Board decision was struck down by the courts is that they found that the federal government did not follow through in its fiduciary duty to consult Indigenous people in a number of cases, right? Because they basically just went into communities and they just took notes when the communities were like, this is going to mess up our economy and like our resort and like our ways of being on this land and everything. And the state was like, oh, okay, noted. And so that actually violated the law according to Canada's responsibility to its Indigenous people or Indigenous people. And so they included so much more of this language around consultation, and they said one of the members of the Environmental Impact Assessment Agency board has to be Indigenous, or like a few members have to be Indigenous. Like they did all of this kind of like very recognition style stuff to overhaul the act. But as far as I'm concerned, and what I kind of argue in the paper is it's basically just the same. It's the same wine in a different bottle. And we've yet to really see, I think we've, it's yet to really be tested again in a major way as it was with the Trans Mountain expansion project, because no one wants to build pipelines in Canada anymore.
Right.
Which is maybe a good thing, but yeah, it's essentially just the same. So as far as the question, can you improve a concept like the public interest? I'm sure that there's like a smarter than me liberal political theorist who could convincingly argue that there actually is something to be said about like, or a different way of thinking about this in a more kind of, I don't know, collectivist sort of way. But I personally just think that it's only ever really been used to build legitimacy. And right. that's all that I think it will ever do.
Right. So it kind of makes sense, like digging at the intention behind the framework when we're thinking about like whether it's reformable or if it's something we want to like overhaul altogether. Right.
Yeah.
I think that makes a lot of sense. So do you have any sort of like hopes for this new modernization era from Trudeau, or are you kind of like, oh, this is just the same thing, but couched in this nice, like other language? Do you think there's anything that might be better or worse about it? Or is it really just, I don't know, same thing wearing different clothes?
Yeah. Okay. So there's this guy named Nigel Banks who and David Laidlaw. They're two people who write a lot for the University of Calgary Faculty of Law blog called the AB Log, like ablog.ca. And they talk a lot about the specifics, like the actual legal specifics of the new legislation and the pros and cons. And they're much more experts on this kind of stuff than I am. So I would direct anybody who's interested in learning more about that to them. But I would say like, my opinion is that this is the kind of classic Trudeau move, is to kind of dress everything up in the language of, you know, reconciliation and like national dialogue and all this kind of stuff, and then not actually, and then be doing something like the complete opposite behind the scenes.
Right.
Case in point with the Trans Mountain Pipeline. I mean, this is a guy whose government was elected on a promise to basically make sure that the pipeline didn't happen. I mean, if he didn't outright say it, that was kind of his whole platform, was like climate justice, Indigenous reconciliation. And then, you know, one of the first big things that he did with his government was to nationalize the pipeline construction of the Trans Mountain expansion, which happened in 2018. And so this is a pipeline now that Canadian taxpayers are paying for. It's going to be about $30 billion is the most recent estimate that it's going to cost, like the public. It was originally estimated somewhere between like $5 billion to $10 billion. It's going to be $30 billion now. And this is a project that the Canadian government nationalized. And so this is where it'd be fun to talk about extractivism, and like the benefits of like extractive-led development, because this is certainly not a project that Canadian people will ever actually see a cent from. This is always, right. This is for its whole existence, it's basically going to be paying off its own debt. And it's not even oil and gas that'll probably stay in Canada for the most part too. Most of it's going to be exported, like I said, to the US. So,
yeah,
you know, that's how I feel about the Trudeau government to kind of, you know, make any good of this.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I learned a lot in the last, you know, half an hour that we've been talking about this. I'm new to
it's
Canada.
It's been fun to talk about this again. I forgot about a lot of this stuff until until today.
No, of course. Thank you for sharing the paper with us. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about kind of the methods behind the paper and also about your use of scale as a conceptual tool, because as kind of geographers, we're interested in such things. So first question here, I think, is like, what methods did you use to inform this research? And did you have a process for making that decision? And maybe you can speak to kind of some benefits and maybe some drawbacks as well of the kind of archival work that you did to write this paper.
Yeah, so this was mostly what I call like laptop research, in the sense that I didn't really do, I just worked on my computer to do all of this. There, like, it was archival in the sense that I was looking through our digital archives, but it was all kind of, the main method that I used in this project to gather data was to submit what's called a freedom of information, or an access to, you know what, I should actually get what that's called proper.
Like Freedom of Information Act or something like that?
Yeah, because there's multiple things. ATIP, yeah. So it's called an access to information. So the main method that I used in the research was access to information and privacy online request. And you can, so the National Energy Board is a public institution. And so you are allowed to submit a request to, you have to pay, and you're allowed to submit a request to see a lot of the internal documents and anything that isn't available kind of like publicly online for the NEB. So I submitted this request. I don't remember the specifics of what the ask was or like the scope, but it was essentially like around the decision-making process. So how the board actually comes to this public interest determination. And then also I wanted to know more about, this was because I was researching this in the context of the modernization process of the National Energy Board. So we already knew this was underway. There was already like a lot of talk and consultation that was happening behind the scenes to overhaul the National Energy Board. So I wanted to look at all of those talks basically, and find the minutes for those meetings, which they did have, and they did send to me. So I got this massive package of like 10,000 pages of material or something like that.
Oh, wow. 10,000.
So I read through this. A lot of it was like internal memos. A lot of it was redacted. I mean, a lot of that was redacted, actually. I did not read through all of 10,000 pages. There was some interesting stuff that I did glean around, you know, how they were thinking about the public interest concept in the reconciliation era in particular. It seemed like there was like an actual recognition among the decision makers and the people involved with the NEB that the public interest can't just be used as a veto tool when there's like Indigenous resistance, for instance. But their solution, as far as I could tell, it wasn't like we should do consultation differently or we should completely revamp this process. It was like, we just can't outright explicitly say public interest and use it to justify these decisions. Like, we need more, which is kind of funny. And then I also read through, in addition to a lot of this kind of like internal stuff that I read through, I also looked through all of the decisions that the National Energy Board has made since it was started doing impact assessments, which go back to, I believe, like the 60s. A lot of them are available online. And then I had them like scan some decisions that aren't available online and send them to me as well. And so I read through all of them and just kind of was looking for some general patterns around how they use the public interest concept and that kind of thing. And then I did like, you know, a pretty close reading of the Trans Mountain Pipeline decision, which itself was a massive document, and tried to kind of compare the way that the impacts and the benefits were framed in the Trans Mountain project compared to previous projects, just to see kind of like continuities and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Wow. That's it's yeah. awesome to kind of just demystify what all the work that goes behind the creation totally. Of this, you know, 20-page paper. Like I saw a meme the other day that was like, oh, like my thesis is like this thin, it's like a thin piece of paper, and then like everything that went into it, and it was like a 10x stack of shit.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's so true that like and academics are often really bad. Well, I mean, social scientists, I guess, are often really bad at talking about methods and explaining right. what we did. And yeah, so you end up just with this black box where you're like, how did this get made?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, definitely yeah. really helpful for us, or at least for me as well, like as I'm just starting to think about my own research, like what kinds of methodologies are possible. So thanks for sharing that. Then the other sure. thing we were really curious about that Yusuf and I kind of, you know, discussed when we were preparing for this was your whole section about scale in the mm-hmm. paper. Do you think you could tell us a little more about how you engage scale mm-hmm. by either with things like state agencies in the impact assessments, and then also just on a scholarly or activist level, like how scale is used to offer a critique? A quote that really jumped out to us, I think, was like the way that you what you say is are like quote unquote scalar tricks are used by the colonial spatial imaginary, which, you know, I really like the way that that's phrased. But maybe like you can deep kind of unpack a little bit what, yeah. what you meant by that for our listeners.
Scale is a really it's a difficult concept to wrap your head around, in my opinion. The way that I love to think about it in a very simple sense, it comes from this person named Max Le Boyrin. They wrote a really good book called Pollution is Colonialism. And there's this whole chapter that they have on scale, or this whole section on scale. And the way that they put it is, scale isn't about relative size. It's about what relationships matter within a particular context. So the very basic way of understanding scale is like, you know, there's certain phenomena that can only be seen at particular units of analysis. So for instance, if you wanted to look at like the mountain range of like the Appalachians or something like that, and you're standing on the mountain itself, you're not going to be able to see the full scale or the full extent of that mountain range. But if you zoom out and you look at that mountain range from a satellite, then you'll be able to see it and the whole extent of it. And there's drawbacks to that. Like you can't see the fine details of the mountain range, but you can also see a lot more of like, you know, the various processes and patterns that make it up. So scale is kind of like a way of, it's both a metaphor and it's a concept, and it's a way of thinking about relative size and also the various processes and relationships that constitute that thing that cross different scales. So another example would be like the one that I use in the paper is like transnational circuits of capital. You can't really, it doesn't, those only really make sense if you look at like the macro level of the global economy, for instance. But if you wanted to look at something like cell mitosis, you can only look at that at the microscopic level, really. And so you're zooming in and zooming out to look at these various relationships. And so I just really like that Le Boyrin quote about it's about what relationships matter within a particular context.
Right. I think what you make me think about here is, for instance, when we're thinking about, you know, what I'm interested in terms of decarbonization technologies and what is happening at the very origin of the extractive process into to feed the whole supply chain, is that you think of an electric vehicle being driven mm-hmm. on a highway in Germany, and you kind of zoom into it, you unpack its battery and you find all these elements. And if you were to track down where they're coming from, you might end up in a place where the electric vehicle itself might even be not even in that landscape, in that picture, and even yeah. in your mind, in your imaginary, but the way that it manifests is in drying water up, is in transforming a landscape from a salt flat to an extractive, like carved out rectangles of evaporation pools. And once yeah. we think of the concept of scale, it allows you to jump in and out and across, right? Like
totally.
I think that's when I was reading your paper, that's what I was thinking about a lot, in terms of, you think of a pipeline and it's going through indigenous land, it's extracting yeah. oil and gas, it's contributing to the climate crisis, it's contributing to a sovereignty crisis, if we can even call it that. And yeah, like transnational capital, for example, when you think of fossil capital, like who are the beneficiaries of this pipeline, and what are these flows of capital that are surrounding this project? So it might look like a project, or like in the case of the mountain range, it might look like just a mountain range, but once you zoom in and out and go across, it paints a completely different picture that you might not even have thought of before.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's really ever explained it to me like that. That was really helpful.
Yeah, it's such a good concept. And like, you know, there's a lot of geographic writing also on the fact of like, you know, the social construction of scale. This is probably something that a lot of folks have heard of. That's basically just getting at the idea that scalar relations, they don't exist just out there in the world. Like it's us humans who are kind of looking at the world and like seeing those patterns and being like, that's a scale. So, you know, the example that I love is from Nathan Sayer, where he talks about like, different ecologies have their own scales, like a river basin, for instance, you know, or a region like an ecological region or something like that. It's almost as though we think that those scales already exist, but it's only because, you know, we're looking at them and we're like thinking of them as such, and the different relationships that they have to other scales, then that's kind of how they become like that particular scale.
Right. And that's the relational aspect as well there.
Exactly. Yeah. And then in the impact assessment context, scale is actually, it's really important because you can't do an assessment. So kind of like Yusuf, what you were just saying, like you have to think of the projects at some extent, you have to think of it as like this spatially bound thing. It has like, you could draw like a circle around where the project is in space, like on a map. And anything outside of that circle is not within the boundary of the project anymore. And thus it's not part of the project's scale. And so what you can do in impact assessment, what happens quite a bit, is you can massage or kind of like manipulate the scale, and both in terms of like the extent of the impacts and benefits, and also like where the project's impacts and benefits begin and end. Mm-hmm. So to give you an example, if you categorize an impact, let's say like with the Trans Mountain Pipeline in particular, like I just said, because this was going to bring in a lot more tankers, a lot more tanker traffic into these sensitive marine environments, there was this risk that it was going to end up decimating a lot of local ecologies for marine mammals and plants and so on. And so what the environmental assessment did, like the NEB's first environmental assessment, is it localized those impacts. So a lot of the environmental concerns, they were scaled down as being like local impacts. And therefore, because it's local, somehow it's less important. That's the logic of the public interest, right? Is like, if something is smaller in size, it doesn't matter as much because it's not affecting as many people. I think it had like the highest that they gave to any kind of environmental impact was like a moderate impact at like the regional level, as opposed to like something that's actually like a national concern. Climate crisis is a national concern, but for whatever reason, it's being scaled down as like a local issue. And so that's what I mean by kind of like this scalar trick, is really like the ways that I, and I'm not necessarily even saying that this was done on purpose. Like, I don't necessarily think that there's like people who are
scheming,
like these evil geographers, yeah, who are like, oh, you know, we need to use scale to weaponize like these impacts. And like, I literally just think that it's because there's not enough, there probably at the time anyway, wasn't enough, you know, reflection and thoughtfulness about what scale actually is and what it means and how it's used in impact assessments. And the effect of it was that a lot of these harms, like the actual impacts of the pipeline, were being downplayed because they were being framed as local. And that's something that's happened, I think, for a lot of Indigenous people probably for a long time, is like the impacts on them and their communities are considered to be local concerns, either because they're like a so-called minority population, or because the extent, like the scalar extent of the impact, was thought to be pretty small. It's like, oh yeah, this pipeline might leak every now and then into the river that you rely on for your livelihood, but like, you know, that's a minor issue compared to the overall benefit of the pipeline. So as like an example. Right.
And it's so interesting because it's also like, where does the contribution to the climate crisis through extracting fossil fuels fit into the picture of scale that goes into assessing the economic benefit of a nation? Like if you think of every single project that facilitates fossil fuel extraction and then combustion on a planetary, at a planetary level, at which the climate crisis is unfolding, but we can also argue that there's a lot of local expression of it, of course. But this idea of thinking of economic growth at national levels, extractivism that feed, you know, kind of like resource nationalism, right? On the one hand, and then the climate crisis at a global level on the other is so interesting because it then makes you think, like, for a country such as Canada that positions itself as a nation state that is responsible, quote unquote, when it comes to the climate crisis with its nationally determined contributions at an international level, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
How does it factor even, how does it factor in that image into national projects and local projects, right, within its jurisdiction? And then the other scalar issue of, from my understanding, the impact assessment agency is at a federal level. So that oversees projects that are crossing boundaries, as you said earlier. But then for projects that are happening within provinces, it kind of, it, you know, depending on their size of production and their potential socio-environmental impact, it kind of takes a step aside and it's on the province to determine that, from my understanding. So, so there's also interesting implications about scale there, because if there's a province, for instance, that's overseeing a project on whether or not it's going to be approved, and gives it the green light, like its assessment agency gives it the green light to operate, how does it factor in potential cross boundary socio-environmental impacts when we know historically that a lot of Indigenous communities, these boundaries are obviously fictional?
Yep. Yeah. And I'll just give like one more kind of thing, the way that I think this links really closely to like the colonial, what I call the colonial spatial imaginary. When I had first written this paper and I was discussing it with one of my committee members, Michelle Daigle, one thing that she pushed me on was, you know, she's like, yeah, you know, Michelle, right? From UBC.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, she was really pushing me on this relationship between, you know, scalar violence and colonialism. And thanks to, you know, like a lot of the conversations that we had, or like the readings that she suggested to me, I include this part in the paper, where, you know, the scalar separation of bodies and land is a really essential logic of settler colonialism in Canada in particular. It is this logic that, you know, somehow bodies, like Indigenous bodies, are extractable in the same way that resources are extractable, and that you can separate them from the land. And so that's why you see so many like Indigenous people in climate justice movements or elsewhere refusing this separation. They're saying like an impact to the land is an impact to me. Like there is no separation between land and bodies. That separation is a result of colonialism. And so you can't just say that, you know, what the National Energy Board and other impact assessment agencies do is they say, well, these are so-called cultural impacts. Like the pipeline is going to impact your cultural way of life or something like that. It doesn't, they fundamentally cannot acknowledge the fact that they are extracting bodies from land, and that that is what like so many Indigenous people are trying to get through our heads and like impact assessment agencies' heads. And so that is like, that is, I think, how scale matters in like a colonial sense as well. Colonialism really operates through a lot of kind of scalar work. Even saying something like Canada, the country of Canada, that's you're using a scalar logic whether you realize it or not, because the fact of the matter is that Canada just claims that it has jurisdiction over that whole scale of the nation, but it's made up. I mean, like, we know, thanks to scholars who have talked and like Indigenous people who've helped us understand this concept of jurisdiction, that like Canada never has fully, you know, it has never managed to reconcile, for the most part, like the fact of Indigenous prior occupation. Like they want to kind of like, they want everybody to forget that fact, or to say like, you know, well, Indigenous people couldn't own property anyway, not until the British came in and then, you know, they asserted jurisdiction. And so like, whenever you see this concept of national interest being used, it doesn't get at the fact that the whole concept of the nation is actually really contested and has been since the founding of Canada as a colonial, as a settler colony. And so I think that that's the real scalar trick that gets me, is like, you don't think about that contestation and that long, long history of contestation. You just think, like, you think of a map, probably, like, you know, Canada is the national space or something like that. So I think that that's the real power, in a negative sense, of the concept of the national interest, is that it kind of, yeah, it totally obfuscates any questioning of what the nation actually is. And it's a scalar imaginary.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think as you were talking, I was thinking a lot about the Leon Simpson interview that you had sent us, that was conducted by Naomi Klein back in 2013 around Idle No More and kind of the Indigenous perspective on resistance and the ways forward in environmental policy. And I think one of the things that struck me about this piece was just Leon Simpson's kind of reframing of extractivism, not just as a process, but also a mindset, right? Like, of these liberal institutions just saying, oh, like, Indigenous people are good at environmentalism, so let's just ask them how to do XYZ and then plug in, play it into our existing kind of framework and mindset. And what you were saying about the fundamental inseparability between the body and the land, I think is just something that that liberal logic completely fails to grasp. So maybe, like, you can talk a little bit about kind of some of your takeaways from this interview that you shared and the approach that Idle No More takes as a, like, as Yusuf was saying, like, positioning of the scale as like a counter method, or if you think that their worldview, from whatever you understand, is outside of that kind of scalar logic as well, that's totally fair. But just seeing that as maybe an alternative way to see the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll just preface this by saying again, you know, like, I really would recommend people check out Leanne Simpson's writing.
Yeah, totally. We can link all this in the show notes as well. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm certainly not an expert on this stuff, but I have been, you know, obviously very influenced by a lot of this writing, a lot of Leanne Simpson's writing in particular. I think the one kind of part of that piece that has really stuck with me and how I think about extractivism is this thing around consent. You know, the quote that she has there is, extracting is stealing. It is taking without consent, without thought, care, or even knowledge of the impacts on the other living things in that environment. And so, I mean, you can think about that in a really basic way by looking at, actually, ironically, the way that a lot of impact assessment has actually unfolded in Indigenous communities throughout Canada. And again, I would suggest people check out Carly Dokas's book for more specifics on this, because she does have, like, some really interesting cases where she talks more about this, where, you know, like, impact assessors or, like, academics in general who are trying to go out and suss out so-called traditional ecological knowledge, which is just basically, like, a way of saying, like, Indigenous worldviews and knowledge about the land. So academics and impact assessment people or policy researchers or whatever, they would, like, fly into these often, like, remote Indigenous communities in the north, like, in these so-called, like, resource hinterlands of Canada, and they would go and, like, interview some people. And they would be like, tell us about your traditional ecological knowledge and, like, your relationship to land and stuff. But they're doing it not because they want to better understand, you know, for the sake of, you know, society, the good of society. They're not doing it in that, like, that kind of beneficial sort of way for those communities. They're doing it because they want to understand, like, how can we best establish extraction here, either by, like, minimizing impacts or, like, how can we actually use the so-called traditional ecological knowledge to the benefit of these extraction projects? So this is, like, a very extractive, like, literally, like, extractive way of doing research. You go in, you take what you need, you don't really ask for consent, you're not really doing this for the benefit of those people, you're doing it for kind of your own interest or the class interest that you're aligned with. And then you leave, and you probably never have any relationship to that community ever again. So that's exactly what Leanne Simpson talks about. It's stealing. Like, it's literally stealing knowledge and using it for the benefit of, like, extractivism. And, like, I just, when I think about, like, the National Energy Board in relation to this, like, concept of extraction, that's kind of, like, how I think. It's like, they're not the interest isn't really and never really has been. And the same thing for like the federal government when it's doing these impact assessments and these community assessments, and they go and they do these town halls. Like, the goal at the end of the day isn't for them to, like, you know, find some way for this nation to benefit from the project. They're trying to legitimize the project. They're trying to go in and they're trying to get that consent, but it's not really consent. It's kind of like coerced consent in a way for a lot of these communities, where they either like they don't really have, there's no other options for economic development a lot of the time for those communities except for resource extraction. And so Cliff Atlio is another person who's written about this. Like, a lot of the time communities or like nations, they will choose to engage in these projects because they're doing what's best for their community. And a lot of the time, that's the only form of economic development that's available to them, is through extractivism. So they do it. And then there's a lot of the time where actually the community overwhelmingly does not want the project, like in the case of Wet'suwet'en and the Coastal GasLink pipeline, and they continuously say no, and the state doesn't care and will like find a way to get the project approved anyway. So like, that is, I think that's why this Leanne Simpson's concept of extractivism is so important for like kind of framing all of this, is,
right,
you know, it's stealing fundamentally. I mean, that's what's happening. That's what's always happening with resource geography or like any kind of resource economy in a settler colony, is like, it's just trying to find ways to ensure the flow of those resources, usually out of the settler colony, without, you know, like the consent of the people who actually live there.
Yeah. I would like to read a small piece from that interview, actually, which speaks a lot to this as well, which I found brilliant. Leanne says, "I always get asked, why do your communities partner with these multinationals to exploit their land? It is because it is presented as the only way out of crushing economic poverty. Industry and government are very invested in the jobs versus the environment discussion. These communities are under tremendous pressure from provincial governments, federal government, and industry to partner in the destruction of natural resources. Industry and government have no problem with presenting large-scale environmental destruction by corporations as the only way out of poverty, because it is in their best interest to do so."
Yeah.
So it's, and then she says, it's basically choosing between feeding your kids and destroying your land.
Yeah,
that is the choice really that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I also really like in this piece where Leanne Simpson defines extraction as removing all of the relationships that give whatever is being extracted meaning. So it's like, you're not just taking something, but you're like taking something and kind of like what we were just talking about with respect to scale, is, you know, violently separating land and bodies, is that's extraction. You are extracting the thing from its, or, you know, you're calling it a thing now, you're extracting the relation or the process or the body or whatever from its constituent, you know, relations, and then you're, you know, commodifying it in various ways, traumatizing it, like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Liam, you know what, I don't want to keep you for super long, but I do know that what you're looking at in your PhD is super interesting, and I would also love for Erica, not only the listeners, to learn about it.
Totally.
I know you're in the process. You're in the process of working on it right now, and maybe you're sick of even talking and thinking about it. But I hope this might be helpful for you. And I think, you know, all along we've discussed a lot extractivism in the context of the settler colony and indigenous sovereignty. But there's obviously, of course, a layer that is quite interesting to bring in, which is workers, which you really started with, but workers in Alberta in the tar sands, which I understand is a big part of your research. So maybe talk to us a bit about your research, where you're going with it, and I guess kind of like give us a lay of the land on the landscape for the different political expressions that exist in the working class of this resource frontier. And of course, that would naturally bring us into the discussion of climate justice and the green transition, because that, of course, has a big role to play in this discussion. So
for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. I do love talking about my research. So, you know, stop me if I go on for too long.
But no, please.
No, I'm happy to talk about it. Yeah, so essentially the project, my dissertation project right now is about energy transition in Alberta, and it's specifically more from the perspective of workers who are impacted or who will be impacted by energy transition in various ways, in a multitude of different ways. And my basic objective is to try to understand why some people are more or less attached still to oil and gas and to extractive forms of work, even in this era of energy transition. So the way that I came to this project was, this all happened during the Trans Mountain struggle back in Vancouver in 2017. One thing that I found really interesting when all of those, there were so many different protests that were happening all the time, climate justice rallies, like no more pipeline rallies, this kind of stuff. And I was always interested in the counter protests, because the media loved to cover the counter protests because they want to show there's both sides to this problem or whatever. And the counter protests, they were always smaller, obviously, like way smaller. They seemed like they were like a minority of people. But, you know, there would always be like this rally of like people with the I Heart Oil and Gas shirts, or like the bumper stickers, or like, you know, Canadian Energy, like folks who very clearly, they want this pipeline to be built. They are saying that if this pipeline isn't being built, it's affecting like thousands of people's livelihoods in Alberta. And I wanted to know more about these folks in particular, because I feel like we have to take this seriously. And the reason is that, you know, I learned about the Just Transition strategy also around this time. For those who are want a little bit of a refresher, the Just Transition strategy, it comes from labor organizers and anti-war activists in like the 1960s. That's usually where the genealogy is traced, like 1960s, 1970s. And the strategy is, let's organize these workers who work in like petrochemicals, or who work in the military, or whatever this like, you know, bad industry that we need to transition out of, we need to like get rid of it. Let's organize those workers and get their buy-in. And we're going to ask them to sacrifice, to make a sacrifice. We're going to ask them to actually sacrifice their jobs, but we're going to promise them a spot in the peacetime economy or in the post-fossil economy or whatever. So that's the strategy. It's like, it's actually getting workers who work in these industries to invest in the end of those industries with the promise that there's going to be a place for them, like not just a job, but like an actual meaningful place for them in the successive economy or whatever that society is going to look like. So I think it's a really fascinating, like it's brilliant. It's like a classic like labor organizing strategy, right? Climate justice movement, environmentalist movement for the most part, hasn't really been that good, I think, at engaging like people who work in these sectors and people whose livelihoods depend on these sectors. And I think that's a huge missed opportunity, and it's a persistent problem that is still faced to this day. And there's a lot of reasons for that, and we can talk about why, but essentially that's where I was starting with this project. I definitely don't agree with like the United We Roll convoyers, the pro pipeline folks and this kind of thing, but I want to actually understand where they're coming from, not just in like a rational sense. I actually want to understand like how they think and feel about energy transition and how they see it potentially impacting them. You know, I hear people talking, for instance, about like the effects of, you know, in Alberta, when there's a bust in the oil and gas sector, they're like, you know, families are harmed. They talk about it mainly in terms of their personal connections, like people who are losing jobs and who are becoming homeless, or who are like having to downsize or whatever. They're like facing these really real hardships. And they really truly believe that the answer is more of these extractive projects. And in a way, I think that's understandable. And so I want to know more about why this is, because I think that there's a real kernel of truth, and I want to take it seriously. And this is me kind of coming at this as also like a community organizer. Like this is very much influenced by my own experiences, both as a previous resource worker and also as like a tenant organizer here in Vancouver. Is like, you know, we actually have to, at some point, we have to engage the people who disagree with us, because a lot of the time, our class interests are actually probably going to be more aligned than they are different. And so that's what I really believe about a lot of oil and gas workers in particular. there are actually a lot of oil and gas workers who are also very like pro climate justice in Alberta too. And so it's not always a contradiction. So that's the project, like at a kind of high level view. And I kind of do a lot of historical work to explain, basically to explain the conjuncture, like in a Gramscian sense, or to explain the moment, like how did we get here? What are the various kind of like histories of the various movements in Alberta that have led to this current moment where there are like pro-pipeline factions of the population, where it's very difficult to speak out against oil and gas in Alberta? How did we get here in a movement sense? Like what social movements have created this context? And so I look back at, for instance, farmer protests and like farmer organizing, which has played like a really important role in shaping the political conjuncture in the prairies in general since like the early 20th century. And I look at I look at Red Deer in particular, which is this place in central Alberta, which is a very kind of important regional oil and gas hub. And I look back, I actually go back to the settlement of Alberta, to when Canada unilaterally asserted jurisdiction over this area, signed a treaty with a number of First Nations in that area. And when people came and started colonizing this area and actually like settling. And I kind of trace that to the present as a way of sort of trying to understand how could we possibly be in this moment of climate crisis and people still want pipelines. That's kind of like my big problematic, essentially.
Right.
And when you look at it in these perspectives, what I'm eventually going to argue is that it's actually pretty understandable because nothing else has ever been on offer except for extractivism for most people in Western Canada.
And what is getting to the idea that this is understandable potentially lead to?
I think it gets to a like a place where we can actually like start to have some meaningful conversations about like what compromises need to happen, like what we actually need to do to wind down these sectors in ways that are actually going to get worker buy-in. Because otherwise I think you're just going to continuously see these successions of these like, you know, right-wing populist movements and convoys. And I do think that like, you know, these convoys, like this right-wing populism a la Pierre Poilievre, I actually do think presents a really massive threat to climate justice in ways that maybe get underplayed a lot of the time still today.
I think that's one of the reasons why I think your research is so interesting and important, is because if the left is thinking about just transition without really engaging with what workers in oil and gas actually think and feel, then there is a potential rupture that the right typically exploits, not even potentially will exploit. It's already exploiting it.
Yeah.
And so when I think of your research, I think why it's important to think or get to the conclusion that it is understandable why there are pro-pipeline and pro-oil and gas people in, say, Alberta or workers, is solidarity, simply solidarity, right? Because I think this kind of concept of just transition takes for granted that these workers will just shift gears and start building solar panels or something. Whereas you don't take into account the deeper meanings that or connections that these workers potentially have built with that sector, and that they would have to retrain completely. And you can't just, you know, assume that would.
Oh, yeah. There's so many reasons why, like, I mean, without getting too much into it, there's so many reasons that people don't want to transition that when you hear them, you're actually like, that actually makes sense. So just to give you one example, like, there's the retraining aspect for sure. Like there are a lot of, let's say there's a lot of folks who are in their like 50s in particular, like 50s and 60s, who are just about to retire. They've worked in coal, for instance, for their whole lives. Now there's this coal wind down policy in Alberta, and they're going to be out of work, and they live in these like fairly rural, remote communities. There's no other jobs for them. A lot of them, some of them don't even have high school educations. And they're like years out from retiring and collecting a pension. And they're, a lot of them are just going to be kind of like hung out to dry. And they're like, so they feel expendable. They feel like, you know, there's no use for me anymore. And also like a lot of like a lack of care. Like nobody really cares about my position or my community and these kinds of things. Another example is like resource work, like it's very different. The way that it's organized is very different from like the renewables economy, the renewable sector. And so the renewable sector, from what I understand, like the jobs are much more like the actual kind of skilled trades jobs are much more kind of like gig economy based, because they've emerged in the era of the gig economy. Whereas the resource job, the original kind of like oil and gas extractive resource job, or coal, say, was much more kind of like a regular rhythm, you know, where you either have like a day job and you can expect a job for life, and that you're going to just work this your whole life and then retire quite handsomely, or that you're going to be able to go to places like fly in, fly out camps, and you can go and make a bunch of money. Kind of like what I was talking about at the intro, you could go and make a bunch of money, and then you can go and live your life for the next couple months without having to work. And those, it doesn't really work like that as much in renewables. So it's, and then not to mention the fact that there are very few jobs that pay as well in the resource economy as extractive jobs. They pay so well. And so it's questions of pay, it's questions of like work-life culture, it's questions of livelihood, like they're all questions of livelihood at the end of the day. But I think when you start to hear those reasons, it becomes a lot more, I think, like relatable in a class kind of sense. And like, yeah, like we actually do have a lot of aligned class interests here. It's not just because you're some kind of like reactionary conservative jerk or whatever. I mean, it is in some cases, but like, it's much more systemic.
Right. So Liam,
as my position.
That is, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, kind of related to this, and we do have to close, I think this might be the last question we ask you. Sure. How does this relate to you as a community organizer and your work with the Vancouver Tenancy Union? And if you can talk to us a bit about that, you know, awareness of the nuances of class, as well as your work with the union, and then we can wrap up.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, like, okay, I'll try to keep it brief. Like, I think about it very much in terms of an organizing context, and to be clear about what I mean by organizing, you know, I think of organizing in a very basic sense as trying to build relationships and eventually movements with people whom otherwise you would not agree with. It's like, it's trying to get on board the people who are not on board. If you're trying to build a mass movement, you can't just do it with your friends who agree with you. At a certain point, you need to actually like build alliances, and you need to be making compromises and this kind of thing. And so, you know, I think in a tenant organizing context, obviously it's pretty far removed, I think, from like specifically from oil and gas stuff, but I run into this issue constantly where I feel like, you know, at a certain point, we actually do need to be, for instance, if we're going to hold if we're going to form a building association among tenants in a building, you know, let's say they have some struggle with their landlord and they're trying to form a like a tenants association in their building. And let's say they want to write a letter to their landlord or something like that, or do a rent strike, God forbid, you need like most of the building to be on board. And there are going to be people who don't want to be on board and who just aren't on board. And it takes a lot of like trying to understand their perspectives. And it takes a lot of like conversation and a lot of reflection to kind of understand what those reasons actually are, why they are not aligned with, or why they don't see themselves reflected in the work that you're doing, and why they don't feel like their interests are aligned with yours. And you can't just have some kind of like one size fits all approach and assume that everyone's going to agree with you. You actually have to do that harder work of like I said, compromise and like reflection and really listening and trying to understand their perspectives, especially if you disagree. And it doesn't always work out and it's not always perfect, but I'll tell you, like when I go and door knock in buildings and try to help people form their own tenants unions or whatever in their buildings, like you'd be surprised by how many people you wouldn't consider are like so-called leftists who, once you start talking to them, and when their backs are against the wall and there's a risk that they might lose their housing or that their housing might not become stable anymore, they see that their interests are aligned and they want to actually join the tenants union. And so I think that perspective of like the just the mere facts of movement building, of like what it actually takes to build a mass movement, is going to require these kinds of compromises and working with people who you don't necessarily like and you don't necessarily have any similarities with in terms of your family history or anything like that, but you do have an aligned class interest. That really has shaped, I think, the way that my dissertation research has unfolded.
Super interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Liam, thank you so much for all your insights.
Thank you so much, Liam. That was amazing.
Thank you guys. This has been great.
Yeah, it has been.
I really liked talking to you guys.
That's nice. I'm glad.
Yeah, that's great.
Excellent questions. Thank you for reading my stuff and listening to me go on.
No, thank you so much. I mean, I think Yusuf and I were both feeling a bit unmotivated prior to this conversation, just in general, like not about this, but in our studies at work. And I feel like I feel more reinvigorated since talking to you. So that's been great.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.